In his documentary American Reds, Richard Wurmser tells the story of the Communist Party USA, beginning in the Great Depression when the party was the foremost radical group of its time, through the Cold War when it was virtually destroyed by federal and state governments. Using interviews filmed in 1983 with members and former members of the party, the program explores the contradiction between the party's utopian vision of America and its willful blindness to the dystopian world of the Soviet Union. He is a co-writer, producer, and originator of the four-part TV series The Rise and Fall of Jim Crow, which won the Peabody Award for Excellence in Television. He also wrote, produced, and directed the Emmy-nominated PBS documentary Delta Dreams, Hubert's World, and others. American Reds will air this Sunday night at 10:30 on WLIW 21, and I'm pleased it brings Richard Wurmser here today.
And it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Of course. Okay, so you filmed your subject in 1983. Why did it take so long to get everything produced and ready for a show?
Well, the funding I got was from the National Endowment for the Humanities. And
I thought it was from communist Barack Obama. Go ahead.
Well, that's partially true, yeah, too. But the original funding came from the endowment in 1980. And that was the last years of the Carter administration. So I had done research and development. In those days, PBS was, how should I say, a bit more enlightened. And I explained that, look, I didn't know when I would ever get production funds. We have these people in their 70s who are in the trenches, and that we should really get interviews with them because who knows what's going to happen in 3 or 4 years. And so PBS said, yep, it's a good idea. So they wrote a check for $20,000, and I interviewed maybe about 12 or 13 people who were in the party at that time. The Reagan got elected. Mm-hmm. Political winds shifted.
I would think that would help. Okay.
So needless to say, the Reagan-Bush years, I did not go back to the endowment. And then when the Carter years, when Clinton years came up, I was on the Jim Crow series, and that took eight years to do.
Yeah.
And then again, you know, then the wind shifted again. And I figured when Obama came in that, I had all this great footage, and I just thought I didn't want it to just die. So I wrote a proposal, and they funded it, and we got it funded.
Okay, well, here's my question. Why is socialism, whatever you want to call it, so scary to Americans?
Well, that's an interesting question. You'd have to even go back to answer that question. You have to go back to the 19th century. One of the things that really was a huge shock to Americans was the Paris Commune. And the fact is that the Paris Commune threatened to, in a sense, put away with capitalism and private wealth, had a tremendous impact in America. And so there was an anti-communism, anti-left movement that was very strong in America as early as the 1870s. So what happened in America when the party was formed and radicalism was just a kind of continuation of that. The overt claim is the fact that it is anti-religious, anti-capitalism. But I'd like to put something on make a point here, which I think is important. I didn't make the film as a historical documentary in the sense of once upon a time there was this Communist Party and they did these things and this things happened to them and that was that. That's kind of like once upon a time history, and I'm not interested in that.
Yeah,
I'm interested in history that a certain event might come and go, but there's something that lives onward, a specter, if you will. Mm-hmm. Marx is great, this, you know, specter of communism. Mm-hmm. Communism, I see, is something that it's good to think with, right? It's not a blueprint for the future. It makes us kind of rethink the society that we have, and to think, is there alternate and alternative structures?
Right. That's my question. Did the Communist Party, did they see themselves as like, we're just going to pull in this direction and hope to influence the American government in some ways? Or did they like, we want this to be the system we go with?
Well, originally the Communist Party and some of the people in say is when the Russian Revolution happened, they thought it would just sweep all through Europe and then come to America and it would change. Yeah. By 1930, nobody really believed that anymore. But they did make, and they very seldom really talk communism to working people who they try to recruit, not necessarily in the party, but to recruit in terms of organizing and to build strong labor unions. Mm-hmm. That was their main focus. So, but they always were very keenly aware that we need to have an order, that any changes we make in the system that are positive today can be taken away tomorrow. And I, who was in the civil rights movement, that's where I got started on this idea, because I met communist people who were working in the civil rights movement. I was very impressed by their organizing skills, and they got to a point where they trusted me, so I was able to get the interviews. But they knew that systemically there had to be a change if you wanted to make these changes permanent. The civil rights movement didn't do that. They thought, oh, we can get a bigger piece of the pie in the system. We can have more rights for blacks. We can let women in more. We can do this and so forth. But you see what's happened. A lot of those gains have been taken away.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I think the important thing in the film is that it is not the past. It is our present and future that the Communist Party needs to be looked at and thought, or communism needs to be thought of.
They were big in civil rights. They were very integrated and very progressive. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah. In fact, they were the only party and the only political party that ever made an issue of civil rights. Of course, their great moment was the Scottsboro case, and I was fortunate to interview the last surviving, what was called the Scottsboro Boys,
mm-hmm.
Clarence Norris. And Clarence, who was not particularly politically minded, he never joined the party and so forth, but he, told the story about, being in prison, getting ready to die, and in come these two guys dressed as farmers, who are obviously not farmers, both kind of Jewish lawyers from New York.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, don't worry, you're not going to the electric chair in 1931. And that's when he first met the Communist Party. And the party took that Scottsboro, and they really ran with it. And they not only devised a legal defense, which they had eventually turned over to others who had more ability to appeal the thing in the Supreme Court, but they got on the streets and demonstrated. And black-white unity, and it even came from Stalin. I mean, Stalin himself told to the party, you're not doing enough on recruiting African-Americans, more, more, more. So they were really, in the forefront.
Good for Stalin. This is Neil Brennan. I'm filling in today for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with director and producer Richard Wurmser about his new film, American Reds, which will be on PBS this Sunday. Okay, so you followed the Communist Party from 1930 to 1960. So how many members did they have at that point?
Well, at its peak, the party had, probably after World War II, probably had about 80 to 90,000 members. It's a little hard to say, but I would say if you're talking maximum 100,000, that was the peak. Then you had a lot of people who worked with the party but were not party members. The party's power came not so much from its membership per se. It came from the fact that a lot of left-wing or liberal organizations were willing to work closely with the party. So when Hitler was coming to power, anti-fascism, they could, they were involved in organizations that talking about 8 to 10 million people. They could get a demonstration out there with, hundreds of thousands of people. They weren't party people, They were ACLU people, They were people who were just Jewish organizations that saw what Hitler was, the menace of Hitler. That was their real genius.
It sounds like they would work with a lot of other groups. It sounds like they were highly cooperative in terms of somewhat marginalized groups like women, African-Americans, and Jewish groups.
Yes, in the 30s, so much so. Prior to that, no. Prior to that, they were very kind of sectarian and militant. They, Stalin had broken from, in his political struggles with Trotsky and Bukharin and others, he kept switching from left to right, and in 1929, he kind of sensed the depression was coming. He was looking at the employment statistics in America, and he was saying, this is going to crash. And, it was the Jazz Age. Nobody believed him. Depression came, and he thought, this is now the revolution was coming. When it became clear that, A, it wasn't coming, and number B, the United States were willing to recognize him diplomatically, he changed the... And Hitler came to rise. Then he got afraid of Hitler. And then the party switched its line. And then it became exactly as you describe it, very cooperative with everybody.
they were influential, I think, in terms of things that the government implemented. The Great Depression caused massive unemployment. One in four Americans lost their jobs. But the American Communist Party, did they work for unemployment insurance?
They worked for unemployment insurance. Yeah, definitely. They worked for relief. They worked for, and they're very influential among a number of congressmen who were pushing that.
But they were not happy with the New Deal, apparently.
Well, that's funny. They were not happy in the New Deal until the party line changed. The party line changed in 34, 35.
Okay.
And then they were called on the carpet for being critical of the New Deal. So then they became happy with the New Deal.
Okay.
That the problem was that...
Yeah, because it seems like a win. The New Deal feels like a win. I don't know.
Well, the New Deal was capturing the attention of the workers who they wanted to capture.
Okay.
And so they felt that... Roosevelt's goal was to save capitalism, which was true. His goal was to save capitalism, but at the same time to expand safety nets for working people primarily,
right.
Which he would compromise on. He would say, well, working people, yes, but not farm workers.
Right, but Communist Party is kind of a giant safety net in a weird way. You know what I mean?
It was advocating for,
right.
for you know, universal, for a, kind of a universal safety net for all working people, irregardless of, you know, race, ethnicity, and so forth. That was their big push. And that was worked very well until 39.
And what happened in 39?
The pact. So Stalin signed the pact with Hitler. And that changed, and the whole game changed. But where their real moment, I think, was in the late 30s, even through the 40s, is that they were the heart and soul, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but they were the major element in the CIA's organizing drive.
Mm-hmm.
By the time the organizations were completed in the early 40s, the Communist Party were basically in charge of 18 CIO unions.
Wow.
And yeah. Now, they were you were talking about your rat interview before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a great story with Mike Twill, who was head of the Transport Workers Union. And he was, I don't know if he's a member of the party, but he certainly worked very closely with the party. And the Daily News reporter interviewed him, and he said, he was from Ireland, and he was an Irishman. He had this broad brogue, which I can't really imitate, but he was asked by the news. He says, the business leaders of this community say that you're a red, Mr. Quill. What do you have to say to that? And Quill leaned back, and he says, let me tell you, me boy, he says, it's a far, far better thing to be called a red by the rats than a rat by the reds.
There you go.
And so, but Quill, you know, nobody gave orders to Quill, you know, or any of the leaders of the labor unions.
So what I want to ask is, you know, so they were all dedicated to making America more democratic, fair to workers, women, less racist. At the same time, they believed in one of the most tyrannical regimes in human history, the Stalin Soviet Union. One of the people you interviewed, Samuel Adams Darcy, tells the story of meeting Stalin. And then how did they have any idea how brutal Stalin was?
Well, most of them, no. Most communists did not. When the trials came, they... at least outwardly assume they were guilty. Did the top leadership know some of the people? I think some of the top leadership knew what was going on, but also thought that it was justified. I mean, Earl Browder's famous or infamous statement is, well, you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs,
mm-hmm.
meaning you can't get socialism without having to get some ballots. I don't think anybody was aware of the extent of it that was going through, although there were reports, but, you know, it's like true believers. It's like, it's like telling, you know, a really evangelical fundamentalist Christian who believes that the world was created in 6,000 years, and you talk about dinosaurs in a million years. No, that can't exist, you know. And then I'll say, were you there? How do you know? You didn't see the dinosaurs. It's the same kind of thing. When Khrushchev began to reveal the extent of Stalin's drive.
Yeah, what did they do then?
Huh?
What did they do then?
They tried to reform the party and break with the Soviet Union. They wanted to have an kind of independent, you know, or if the connection would be kind of minimal, they wouldn't take orders from Moscow anymore. And there was a huge fight, and in the end they lost those reformers. So you lost about 70 to 80% of that membership left. There was a resurgence after that. coming out of the universities, and where you get Angela Davis mm-hmm. and others who were then kind of a new generation of people in the party. One woman who I knew and who I really admired for her organizing skills and dedication, her name is Charlene Mitchell.
Mm-hmm.
She's the person who provided me with the contacts so I could interview and film interviews with people in the party. And I always avoided talking about their party line and ideology. What I was interested in is what they did when they were in the trenches. So Gus Hall, who was head of the party and who gave you party speak as if you wanted to interview him, he was an organizer, a steel worker in 37, 38, you know, when they were massacring and shooting down steel workers. So I said, you know, what was that like? You know, take us through that experience. So the richness of the film is the fact that when these people talked about what they were doing because of their dedication to a certain ideology, that's, I felt, was the strength of the film, and that's what the film is.
And then a lot of them were wiped out by figuring out that Khrushchev, you know, between that and J. Edgar Hoover, they sort of did them in, correct?
Yeah, but by the time by the time the party had gotten over the worst of Hoover, the membership was probably down to about 30,000. Now, that could have been still a strong enough thing. Then came Khrushchev on top of that.
Right.
Right, and then Gus Hall and the hardliners, because you had the Hungarian, you know, the attempted, the uprising in Hungary and Khrushchev crushing that, you know, by the time you're down to a few thousands, and then it built up again. And I don't know what the numbers were at that particular time. But it was just...
Yep. American Reds debuts this Sunday, October 9th at 10:30 p.m. on WLIW 21. We posted additional broadcast times on our show page at wnyc.org/lowpate. And my great thanks to director and producer Richard Wormser for joining us today. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.